I'm Reverend Lisa Day, minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Welcome to our weekly radio program, where you'll hear a segment from one of our recent services recorded at our church on beautiful Troop Square. We invite you to join us Sundays at 11 a.m. in person or via live stream on Zoom. You can find the Zoom link and more about Unitarian Universalism in Savannah at our website, uusavannah.org. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And happy time change. I'm Mary Garofalo, and I'll be serving as worship associate today. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. Our minister, Reverend Lisa Day, is our worship leader this morning. Eric Swanson will be our love at the center moment. Our worship, religious education, and covenant group theme for March is paying attention. Here at the UU Church of Savannah, we are working to build a diverse, multicultural, and beloved community. We celebrate the presence and participation of people of all races, genders, sexual orientations, abilities, and ethnic and national origins. We warmly welcome you on YouTube and on site, whoever you know yourself to be, and wherever you are on your journey. With the lighting of our chalice, symbol of our Unitarian Universalist faith, we enter into the sacred time. We gather the hours as people of faith, with joy and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together. These are words by Christine Robinson.
It would be a thousand pities if women wrote like men, or lived like men, or looked like men, for if two sexes are quite inadequate, considering the vastness and variety of the world, how should we manage with only one? Ought not education to bring out and fortify the differences rather than the similarities? For we have too much likeness as it is. And if an explorer should come back and bring word of other sexes looking through the branches of other trees at other skies, nothing would be of greater service to humanity. Let us worship together.
Hello, all. So, morning, yeah. So, I'm Eric Swanson. Thank you for the introduction, Mary. For today's Love at the Center, I will be sharing a short poem by Wendell Berry and then a short reflection. Before I do that, I would like to say thank you for the love you all have shared to me and my family. My little family would be a really easy topic for Love at the Center, but instead, I've decided to talk about something hard for me, which is grief. But back to the poem. Wendell Berry writes, "A meeting. In a dream, I meet my dear friend. He has, I know, gone long and far, and yet he is the same. For the dead are changeless. They grow no older. It is I who have changed, grown strange to what I was. Yet I, the changed one, ask, 'How you been?' He grins and looks at me. I've been eating peaches off some mighty fine trees." This poem is from the selected poems of Wendell Berry, published by Counterpoint in 1999, which is actually a long time ago, if you stop and think about it. I have read a lot of Wendell Berry. It is safe to say that my love for his writing is a centering force. So when this poem popped up on my cell phone screen recently, I was both struck by its pertinence to my life and also surprised it was the first time I was seeing it. I am, after all, just a bit hung up on how poets process grief. All this to say that this poem is my love the center, because it reminds me that with love there is loss and grief and remembrance and letting go. Love is choosing joy, like my friend Eric Skelton and Seth Ernst and Lexi Kamerman and Gary Hom and Wanda Wilcox and many others. Lovely people who have touched my life and those of many others, brought joy and are gone too soon. The list for me goes on, and I'm sure it does for you. Let us honor them now, if you choose, by saying them, their names are sitting in silence. Let us always give space for grief by loving strongly those whose precious presence define your love at the center. Thank you.
Our first reading this morning is a Facebook post by Susan Hyatt earlier this week, in fact, last Sunday. Two women who are Olympic gold medalists and the star of the biggest queer show on television walked onto the SNL stage Saturday night and did something the men's hockey team has refused to do for an entire week, the work. Saturday night on SNL, the women's hockey team cleaned up the men's mess again, and everyone is calling it classy. Here's what happened. Connor Story hosted Saturday Night Live. Story is the breakout star of Heated Rivalry, the queer hockey romance that is the biggest show on HBO Max. He brought out Jack and Quinn Hughes first. And then Hillary Knight and Megan Keller walked out to the loudest ovation of the night. Knight's line, "It was going to be just us, but we thought we'd invite the guys, too." Keller, "Yeah, we thought we'd give them a little moment to shine." The men bragged about winning gold for the first time in 46 years. Knight responded, "The last time we did that was two whole Olympics ago." It was funny and sharp, perfectly handled. The internet is calling it gracious, classy, the high road. Kudos to SNL for bringing everyone together. Kudos to the women for sharing the spotlight. And I need to make a deeper point about that. I'm sure the men's hockey team is navigating a PR nightmare and looking for a way to rehabilitate their image. I am sure the women are genuinely friendly with these men. Their families overlap and communities overlap. I'm sure it's all more nuanced than social media makes it look. All of that can be true, and this can be true also. Last night, or Saturday night, the star of the biggest queer show on television and two women did the emotional labor of rehabilitating the reputation of men who have not apologized. Think about who was on that stage. Connor Story is the star of the most significant queer television show in years. Heated Rivalry has introduced millions of people to a story about two male hockey players in love. It has changed the culture around hockey and masculinity. This was his moment, his SNL debut, and he shared it. Hillary Knight is the most decorated American hockey player in Olympic history. She scored the game-tying goal with 2 minutes left. She has 5 Olympic medals. This was her victory lap, and she shared it. Megan Keller scored the gold medal-winning goal in overtime. She is one of the greatest defense women in the history of the sport, and she shared it. Now think about what the Hughes brothers did last week. They wore USA 45/47 hats to pose with White House staff. Their teammate Tag Thompson wore a MAGA hat through the Capitol. They attended the State of the Union as a guest of a president who turned their female teammates into a punchline. They sat there while he took credit for inviting the women. They partied at a Miami strip club while the women were being asked to explain the men's behavior in press conferences. And then they stood on the SNL stage next to the star of the biggest queer television show, a star about hockey players who have to hide who they are because of the culture of their sport. They stood next to a man whose work is actively expanding what masculinity looks like, while they had just come from shaking hands with an administration that is systematically stripping away the rights of LGBTQI plus people. Executive orders rolling back protections, attacks on trans kids, bans on diversity initiatives. That is what those hats represent. Connor Story shared his spotlight with them anyway. Knight and Keller shared their spotlight with them anyway. That is three people doing generous, gracious, public-facing labor so that two men could stop looking bad without ever having to say the words, "I'm sorry." The headlines today all say the women took the high road. I want you to notice who is always assigned the high road. It's women, queer people, and people who were harmed. They are expected to be gracious and smooth things over. They are expected to share the stage with the people who disrespected them and smile while doing it. And when they do, we call them classy, as if that's the highest compliment a woman can receive. She handled her own mistreatment with grace. Nobody asked Jack Hughes to go on SNL and apologize. Nobody demanded he take the high road. He just got to stand there smiling, missing his two front teeth, wearing a gold medal, while the women and the star of a queer show did all the heavy lifting of public reconciliation for him. This is the invisible workload. Women win, then clean up. Women achieve, then smooth over. Women dominate, then get praised for not for their dominance, but for how nicely they handled the men who couldn't match it. I love Hillary Knight. I love Megyn Keller. I love that they were funny and fierce and generous. And I refuse to let "she took the high road" be the story. The story is that she shouldn't have had to have. The story is that they shouldn't have had to. The story is that they had gold medals around their neck and were still doing cleanup. The story is that those men let the star of a queer show and two women do the work they refused to do themselves. Jack and Quinn Hughes, the words you're looking for are, "I am sorry." Try doing your own labor for once. And our second reading comes from Reviving Ophelia by Mary Piper, published in 1994. Something dramatic happens to girls in early adolescence. The selves of girls go down in droves, crashing and burning in a social and developmental Bermuda Triangle. Studies show that their IQ scores drop and their math and science scores plummet. They lose their resiliency and optimism and become less curious and inclined to take risks. They lose their assertive, energetic, tomboyish personalities and become deferential, self-critical, and depressed. They report great unhappiness with their own bodies. Girls know they are losing themselves. One said, "Everything good in me died in junior high." Wholeness is shattered by the chaos of adolescence. Girls become fragmented, their selves split into mysterious contradictions. They are sensitive and tender-hearted, mean and competitive, superficial and idealistic. They are confident in the morning and overwhelmed by anxiety by nightfall. They rush through their days with wild energy and then collapse into lethargy. They try on new roles every week. This week, the good student. Next week, the delight. And the next, the artist. This book suggests that adolescent girls experience pressure to split into true and false selves. Adolescence is when girls experience social pressure to put aside their authentic selves and display only a small portion of their gifts. This pressure disorients and depresses most girls. They sense the pressure to be someone they're not. One girl put it this way, I am a perfectly good carrot that everyone is trying to turn into a rose. As a carrot, I have good color and a nice leafy top. When I'm carved into a rose, I turn brown and wither. Here end the readings. So this is a good moment to remind you that though we split with them theologically, we are, in fact, the descendants of the Puritans who regularly had 2- and 3-hour-long church services. You know, it's not going to be that long, but if you need to be someplace at noon, you're going to miss the end of it. Once upon a time, as part of a junior high school project with who knows what pedagogical purpose, my sister created a construction paper booklet with the lyrics to Helen Reddy's anthem, I Am Woman, illustrated with pictures clipped from magazines. At Mom's suggestion, on the final triumphant spread, Kathy slipped in one of her own school pictures. So there they were, the women of the times, Golda Meir, Jackie O, Barbara Walters, Billie Jean King, Gloria Steinem, Pat Nixon, Chrissy Evert, Phyllis George, Kathy Day. It was a touch of Mom's typical creative brilliance. Kathy's teacher loved it. It was also emblematic of the times. Virginia Slims was telling women, you've come a long way, baby. The phrase latchkey children was entering the national vocabulary, and ERA was gathering steam toward its ultimate defeat. The clashing eras that rocked the 1970s in the United States shaped my childhood. In 1962, Mom had been given no choice other than to resign from her job because pregnant women, even married ones, were not allowed to teach second grade. For more than a decade, she stayed home with my sister, my brother, and me, while Dad went to work or, for a few years, graduate school each day. For most of my childhood, we were, for all intents and purposes, a one-career, one-car, suburban starter home family with gender roles straight out of the 1950s. And yet, there was that picture of my sister nestled among those famous, beautiful, powerful women. Mom's idea. Mom, who was one of only 2 of her myriad female cousins to go to college, her sister being the other one, because their father insisted that even if they never needed to, they would be prepared to support themselves. And there was our Unitarian Universalist Sunday School, where we saw and heard gender equality celebrated in the Free to Be You and Me film and record album, prompting Mom to bring the book into our home when it was eventually published. So it is perhaps not surprising that I grew up to answer a calling many still consider non-traditional for women. My sister, on the other hand, grew up to follow our grandmother and aunt into one of the most traditional women's careers, nursing. She did it with her own non-traditional twist, however. When my niece, their first child, was born, my sister was both more satisfied in her career and more highly paid than was my brother-in-law in his. So Chuck stayed home with the kids, and Kathy became the primary and, at times, sole wage earner in the family. Let me be clear, there were adolescent bumps and moods along the way, but my sister and I flourished in the love of our family, the embrace of our Unitarian Universalist Church, and the burgeoning possibilities of our era, each in our own distinct way, despite being girls and then women in a world that isn't kind to girls and women. But so many are not as fortunate as we were. When I first preached a version of this sermon 16 years ago, when my niece turned 13 on International Day of the Woman, I had little reason to believe her experience would be much different than mine. She has a strong, professional, loving mother, an attentive, engaged, loving father, and a family Unitarian Universalist church where she sees a variety of gifted women preaching, directing the music program, and running the religious education program. And sometimes she sees gifted men in all those roles, too. And as soon as she was able to talk, she demonstrated great adeptness at bossing her brother and male cousins around. In fact, long before she reached double digits in her age, my sister predicted that Claire would grow up to be the dictator of a small country. Having turned 29 yesterday, she's not that yet. But she does serve on the Board of Trustees at the same UU church that helped raise her. She successfully petitioned her city to change the signage on a small street near her apartment so that fewer drivers would get parking tickets without knowing why. And she is actively involved in the on-the-ground resistance effort in Minnesota in a variety of capacities. She also is very attuned to the perils of the time we lived in. I had to negotiate with her about what I could say about her current activities that wouldn't jeopardize her security or that of the people she volunteers alongside and the people she assists. From one perspective, things look pretty good for Claire and other young women. After all, in the years between her 13th birthday and her 29th, we've seen the number of women on the Supreme Court rise to 4. We've had a female vice president. The BBC has given us a couple female Doctor Whos. And Greta Gerwig, who, by the way, grew up in the UU Church in Sacramento, has given us the Barbie movie. Nevertheless, I do worry about Claire. And I worry about my 20-year-old daughter, Lucia, who came into my life at age 9, 11 years ago this month. She has me. She has Claire as a role model, and she has my sister and my mom, who on a cold Minnesota January Saturday, when I was busy writing a sermon or conducting a memorial service or some other church business, took her to her first protest march, the Women's March in 2017. She's seen lots of other women in the pulpit too, including her godmother, but I worry about her nevertheless. And I worry about Lena, who we blessed this morning, and about Osa, and Finley and Wanda, and Zoe with a Y, and Lydia, and Lily and Abby, Patty Grace and Gwen, Amelia, and Ava and Daggy and Aria and Adeline, and all the girls in our families and our neighborhoods and around the globe. I worry because I studied literature, theology, cinema, and Christian scriptures with feminist professors. I'm well-read and media-savvy, though struggling to become fully social media-savvy. I know that when Mary Piper published Reviving Ophelia in 1994, things like sexting and pregnancy packs and misogynistic bullying in the gaming world and scores of other avenues of daily attack on women weren't even on the horizon yet. Having once served for 7 years on the board of a YWCA that functioned as a residential chemical dependency program and domestic violence shelter, I've heard the stories and the statistics too many times. Beyond the stories and the statistics, I know my friends, my colleagues, and members of this congregation. Not a victim type among them, among you. Yet all have been victimized because of their gender and are now survivors, as are one out of every 3 women in this country. I won't tell you their stories or even name the kind of violence they've experienced because I haven't issued a content or trigger warning. I'll simply say again, the world is a dangerous place to be a girl or a woman or female presenting. And your circles are filled with as many stories providing evidence of that danger as mine are. Just look around and count off groups of 3 women in this room. I worry about girls and women, and I get angry. So I seek out ways to take action so that the anger and the worry don't become debilitating or make me bitter. I stuck out my 7 years on that YWCA board, though it was a rocky time in that organization's development. Sticking it out was one action I took to combat the anger and fear and worry. It was also a terrific learning experience. I learned how many of the women who entered the chemical dependency program also had need of the domestic violence program, and vice versa. I learned about the importance of tailoring treatment programs for women and of providing services to their children as well. I learned about the power of creating special opportunities and experiences just for middle school and junior high school girls, focusing on their needs, gifts, and talents at that critical age. About the power of giving them the undivided attention of outstanding women in a variety of arenas. Attending and giving financial support to V-Day events, which use Valentine's Day as a platform for speaking out against violence against women. Walking in a Week Without Violence march, joining the annual Good Friday counter-protest at a Planned Parenthood clinic, serving as a founding board member and president of a small shelter for unhoused mothers and their children, giving my niece and my daughter books with strong female characters, and preaching here this morning are some of the other ways I take action. Perhaps my most significant action in support of girls and women is simply living the life I'm called to live. Elsewhere in her book, Piper writes of the importance of surrounding adolescent girls and adolescent boys with androgynous adults. Androgynous, in her discussion, has nothing to do with losing or disguising one's femininity or masculinity. It means people who undertake tasks out of love or necessity without regard to gender. Women who change tires and men who change diapers, for two hopefully now very dated examples. My daughter and my niece and my nephews have seen me cook, preach, serve on boards, and support a family. They've seen their parents of both genders and their aunts and uncles cook and succeed in chosen professions and raise families and maintain households. Absorbing, I hope, the message that almost no task, job, or role in life is bound inextricably to a particular gender. Many of you will be familiar with the witticism often mistakenly attributed to Gloria Steinem. A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. In reality, the declaration was the brainchild of Irina Dunn, an Australian educator. I set out determined not to use it in this sermon because I see no value in denigrating men or giving new life to the tired and misguided argument that feminism seeks to do away with the necessity of men. But then I did an internet search for quotes about women and was dismayed by the discovery that the majority of hits were not about women at all. Rather, they were about women in relationship to men, or more frequently, women in comparison to men. It was enough to make me abandon my high ideals and long for a T-shirt emblazed with the "like a fish need bicycle" slogan to wear here in the pulpit. I want my daughter, my niece, all our girls and young women to know in their very bones that they are who they are, period. Not how they measure up against their brothers or male cousins or friends. Not the ways in which they are similar to or different from their male classmates. And I want you who are women to know that too. They are who they are. You are who you are. Precious. Powerful, worthy of celebration, and deserving of protection. Before I end, my daughter has three brothers. I have three nephews. Almost all of my friends raised or are raising boys. We've got an amazing crop of boys and young men here at UUCS. I worry about those boys too. I worry about all our boys and all our non-binary children and youth just as much as I worry about the girls. The world is a dangerous place for them in different ways. One day I'll preach those sermons. But today, on International Day of the Woman, this one's for the girls. Amen.
This is Reverend Lisa Day. I hope you've enjoyed this program from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Savannah. please join us at one of our services sometime soon at our church on Troop Square or live on Zoom. We're the beacon of liberal religion in Savannah, and you can find out more at uusavannah.org. We meet on Sundays at 11 a.m. Thanks for listening.